Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona. Now, I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening for another exciting broadcast in our series, The Minuteman. Tonight, part 9 in the series. But first, some announcements. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time or HOT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940. Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com. The studio number, 928-333-2942. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And ladies and gentlemen, I want you to remember that we are listener-supported. Without your support, we cannot maintain our operation and expand it. We've had a lot of new events coming around behind the scenes. We haven't talked about them much on the air until we were done. The new release of the Sedona speeches by Bill. This is one of his most sought-after speeches ever, I believe. Right up there with his Hollywood and Las Vegas engagements. Now, what these are is we have literally hundreds of video tapes of speeches and engagements, workshops, etc. And we gathered them all up and went through just a cursory overview of what was usable, because sometimes the quality just wasn't there because of lighting or what have you, sound. Others were basically repeats where they may have been done two nights in a row, the same engagement. And then with the tremendous help of the crew up in Canada and James in New York, James that produced and filmed and everything, the documentary on Bill, we have started getting these all converted to digital and editing in the sense of getting rid of the junk that you don't need. Not for content, but when cameras are still rolling during breaks, things like that. Or on 5 minutes before anything ever started. Sound discrepancies, changing volume, etc. So, Sedona was the first one to be tackled, and it's done. It's a 4-DVD set, all in a one quad case, it's called. Holds all 4 DVDs in one case. We've also engaged in the internet television program through Christian Media. Go to CMRI.TV, Charlie Mike Romeo India.TV. James has spearheaded that, of course. And we are on Mondays and Fridays, 2 and 5 Pacific PM in the afternoon. I have tons of people ask me times over and over again. So let's make it clear. Monday and Friday, 2 and 5 p.m., that's in the afternoon, Pacific time. That's where James is at, so he uses Pacific time. Makes sense. So if you're on the East Coast, figure 5 and 8 p.m. 30-minute segments, and Monday was the debut. Friday it will air again. The same shows, and next week will be a new set of shows. That gives you 2 days, 4 viewing slots to catch it. This is an exciting venture, and we've got a lot of these things that we're going to be rolling out, more video projects, etc. That's how we need to keep expanding. For instance, all the engagements that Bill and I did, the last two conferences in the 90s, the Symbology conferences, some engagements we did in the home have never been converted. No one's ever seen them unless you happen to attend. And like the Symbology conference, which is 2 full 8-hour days with only a 30-minute break for lunch, that's it. We had to cap the door entrance to 200 people. That way the whole crowd could see all the audio-visual that we had. Segments on big screen TVs, overhead projections. We had all sorts of different media to show the symbols and Symbology out there. That's, unless you were one of those 200 people, Saturday and Sunday, back in 1997, you wouldn't have seen it ever. So that's the type of things we're doing. Also, we have the opportunity to get onto some other stations as well. Mom and pop, but good, reliable, strong signal AM and FM stations. Some of them cover a vast area of territory. So we need your support, ladies and gentlemen. We don't have corporate sponsorship, so we can say what needs to be said without being gagged. You don't have to listen to commercials every 3 minutes for 3 more minutes. You get programming after the initial announcements and research. Now also, when you're on our website, hourofthetime.com, don't forget to look at the Conference 2007 page. Conference 2007. You've still got plenty of time to get prepared, make travel arrangements, pay tuition. You will not get a deal like this anywhere else with this content, especially not at this price. All meals included, plus snacks throughout the day and beverages. Indoor and outdoor activities both intermingled throughout each day, so it doesn't just become a mundane, boring classroom setting. Field exercises, indoor exercises, guest speakers, binders, notebooks, writing, implements, all that given to you on the very first morning. They're yours to take home. You can mark them up all you want during the week. Presenters that use PowerPoint or any other projection type media, like last year, you'll get it before you go home on a CD or DVD. So you even have their actual presentations to refer back to. So it's a wonderful deal. I suggest you look into it because each year is really a once-in-a-lifetime event because we don't just rehash the same thing every year. It's always different. And if you're not ready for the times that are coming through skills, and we've chosen the skills each year on purpose to build on a base of knowledge. And that's why if you weren't there last year, the DVDs are available. The only thing you're missing is the ability to ask some question, but you'll probably find out, and I've gotten this from people who have bought the DVDs, that everything they would have asked got asked during the question and answer session. Pretty much when someone asked a question, it covered half the crowd. So, and it went on like that, and everybody would think of a different thing and whatnot. So you're really not missing much of the speaker's content with the DVDs, except, like I say, the hands-on help and instruction, you know, right there at your table. So you have the ability to go back and review last year's if you wish. And if you're a paid attendee of this year's conference, we have special pricing on last year's DVDs just for you. So if there's something that you want to just see again, you were there last year and you're coming this year and you want it for your records, or if you weren't there at all last year and you think that you want to build on a base, they're available at special pricing. Contact me, hourofthetime@hotmail.com, and we'll work something out. Now remember, we always take barter as well, ladies and gentlemen. It's not uncommon for me to for goods, and I've gotten all sorts of crazy goods, books, old silver coins. I don't mean old as an antique, just junk silver, if you will. It's still silver, though. in exchange for a broadcast. And even if you contact me now where it's early enough so that if I have to barter off some silver or gold for Federal Reserve notes to cover expenses for some outside person like the cooks or facilities or vehicles or security during the conference. So don't wait till the week before the conference to say you want to pay me in a gold coin, 1 ounce coin or something. Because I will take it, but you may put us in a really tight bind. So if you want to do something like that for your tuition, let me know. Okay, well, like I say, tonight is episode 9 in our Minuteman series. So be sure to get your notebooks during this musical break, about 3 minutes long. Notebooks, pens, pencils, whatever handy, drink of water, and be ready to listen and learn more of the things that you need to know for your Minuteman bands if you're serious about saving our constitutional republic and defending it against the upcoming strike, the upcoming collapse that will occur. Infrastructure, politically, economically, enemies both foreign and domestic. So here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Be back in about 3 minutes. ladies and gentlemen. Again, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with part 9 in our Minuteman series, Need to Know Information. And when the series is done, I will be tacking on my tactics series, because it goes hand in hand, and my psychological warfare series, taken right from my manuals that I used in the Army, in schools, in the Army, verbatim out of U.S. government text, because they go hand in hand with this series. And then we'll bundle the whole thing as an MP3 disc and a special offer for your donations. Now remember, as I stressed yesterday, today we're going to get into an introduction to guerrilla warfare. But one of the main things to think about is not only the historical ramifications that partisan or guerrilla warfare has proven in the aid of their countries and saving their freedom and defending their countries against standing armies, domestic agent provocateurs, enemy partisan bands. And also remember that as we go through this, don't necessarily try to memorize exact historical facts. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not the intent here. It would be best to take the principles of guerrilla warfare that a given action exemplified, and the facts or applications of those principles as we go through this. Now, we covered several campaigns around the world where people were able to use this to great effect to defend their country, which you're going to have to do, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, our government has no program that is at all useful or effective in stopping socialism. And foreign powers that already have people all over the country and in office all over, and, of course, their foreign standings, are building up. We are getting set up for a big fall, ladies and gentlemen, and it's up to the American people to reestablish a constitutional Republican form of government and our freedoms, and it's up to our neighbors as well. But before we get into the core content, I did have one more announcement that I thought of during break. It's important, I feel. It may seem very stupid to some of you, but I don't think it is. So now, if you don't know how it works, I'm going to give you a nutshell explanation of how appropriations bills work. Okay, the legislative branch appropriations bill at the federal government is coming up. And it is coming up tomorrow. A vast set proportion of it, that is. Tomorrow, it's coming up. June 21st. Now, what they have chosen to do, the Senate, has chosen to skip the subcommittee markup on the bill, opting to mark up the bill before the full Senate Committee on Appropriations tomorrow. What that does is it doesn't allow anybody that has an interest in funding to any of the programs that this is affecting to see if it's being cut, rearranged, eliminated, until it's presented to the full committee. That's why there's usually a subcommittee markup first. You need to call your senators. Now, the head of this committee, for instance, is Robert Byrd, known socialist of West Virginia, and subcommittee chairwoman Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. Also, call your own senators. You can use the Capitol switchboard, 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121. And you might be amazed at how they can gut programs without anybody knowing by skipping this markup subcommittee. Now, one particular thing I want to bring up, which irks me because I've seen them in great use. I taught what is called special needs children. during the day and broadcast at night for a couple, 3 years in a regular school. And I used talking books for little blind children, children that had arms that were malformed and couldn't turn pages. I've also helped get talking books for the VA and personally seen them in use and delivered and watched the joy veterans get that have lost their eyesight, crippled by their injuries, can't turn pages, can't hold a book. Because the Talking Book Program out of the Library of Congress is the full, unabridged book. It's not like these ones you buy at truck stops to get the gist of the book as you drive on a to work or on a vacation. They're the full, unabridged book. It's a very important program. Now, I'm just saying my personal experience with the program. It goes on and on and on. Homes for the elderly, disabled, the blind populace in general out there. Healthy as can be. Can't see, though, so it's kind of hard to read. This program may get eliminated completely. Now, this is already known, and without seeing the subcommittee markup session for the legislative branch appropriations bill, no one's going to know until it hits the committee tomorrow. Now, you know what I find striking is here is a way to take books, wonderful books, manuals, etc., that are in publication and make them available to those who have served our country, those who were born, who didn't have a choice in how they were born, those who became blind for whatever reason, that are otherwise healthy, whatever. Plus just a good program out of the Library of Congress, and they're going to try to cut it, if not outright eliminate it. Now, what's so idiotic about this, at the same time, every time some illegal alien starts squawking about they don't have enough rights, the same Senate and government will bend over backwards to hand away your money to them, or even to their foreign country and set them up retirements. How stupid. What has happened in this country, ladies and gentlemen, besides absolute insanity? I bet you if a bunch of illegal, blind, illegal aliens started squawking, the program would get doubled. But for people who serve their country, or legitimate American citizens born here, just less fortunate in their senses, we're going to hurt them. So again, the Senate Capitol Switchboard 202-225-3121. It's a talking book program. And if you want some more detailed information, you can also contact the National Federation of the Blind, who's been out there fighting for this program, not just for their own members, but veterans as well, children, etc. You can contact Jesse Hartle, for instance. Jesse Hartle, 410-659-9314, extension 2233. 410-659-9314, extension 2233. Because remember, the audio section of the Library of Congress and has been in existence since Edison submitted things to them. So it has historical relevance as well in our country's history. Absolutely ignorant. The same time they're doing this, like I say, they're trying to set up retirements for illegal aliens through the Mexican government, while they also reap the benefits of our system. And they're not the only ones, they're just the biggest ones. So don't start squawking and sending me hate mail about our poor Southern brothers. I don't want to hear it. Now, to the content of today's broadcast. As we pointed out, and just finished with yesterday, no nation today can really afford to disregard the resistance potential behind the lines of prospective enemies. Plain and simple. In the time of an occupation, ushered in by enemies foreign and domestic, this can also be converted into guerrilla warfare, which, along with other resistance activities, can destroy a favorable manpower balance in the enemy's camps. You're going to need to study this and how it has occurred in the past, ladies and gentlemen, so that you can understand some of the possibilities that might lie in the future. If you study a history of guerrilla warfare, over the past two centuries alone, you'll see how it has become a sound military weapon, capable of striking the enemy at his most vulnerable points, his morale, combat effectiveness, and industrial capacities. So let's go through some history, ladies and gentlemen. Guerrilla, meaning skirmish or little war, guerrilla, comes from guerra, war, in the Spanish. And the first time that it was known to be used as a word, guerrilla, was in 1807, at least documented use. And that was to fight the armies of Napoleon who occupied all of Spain. And it was when priests, peasants, etc. banded together. The Spanish guerrillas harassed the French troops for 7 years, carrying out raids and ambushes from their mountain hideouts. They killed every straggler that fell behind the main French forces and totally demoralized the occupying armies. The Duke of Wellington, when he invaded the peninsula with his English guardsmen, quickly recognized the value of these guerrillas and kept them supplied through English ships, putting in at Spanish coastal ports. Napoleon, for instance, was forced to divert 50,000 troops from frontline main activities and actions just to guard his own supply lines against guerrilla operations. And he severely rebuked his own generals for their failure to cut the guerrillas off from the English supply ships, realizing that without this aid, the guerrillas would be largely ineffective. It is a classic example of guerrilla warfare on a larger sense in the fact that there's a sponsoring power, in this case England, providing the guerrillas with support, the English supply ships, and the guerrillas operated behind enemy lines to assist a conventional military force, Wellington's army, to defeat the French army. Now in America, we can look back, starting with the Revolutionary War, at some notable cases and guerrilla leaders. Let's look at General Francis Marion, known as the Old Swamp Fox because of his elusiveness down the pass through South Carolina swamps. He brought together a volunteer band of marksmen and fearless riders after the British overran his state during the Revolution. General Marion's brigade often captured superior numbers by total surprise attacks, and terrorized the local Tories. You also have the Green Mountain Boys with Ethan Allen. Let's look at the Civil War. John S. Mosby, he was a lawyer by profession, but he undertook a quasi-independent command behind federal lines in Virginia for Confederate General Jeb Stuart. His guerrilla cavalry units carried out widespread raids against Union troops and even captured the Union Brigadier General Edwin Stoughton during an action. General Grant paid him a high tribute as a guerrilla. Quote, there were probably but few men in the South who could have commanded successfully a separate detachment in the rear of the opposing army and so near the border of hostilities as long as Mosby did without losing his entire command. End quote. And General Lee stated he wished he had 100 men like him and bands. His operations were marred only by the hanging of 7 of his men by General Sheridan, for which he retaliated by hanging 7 of General Custer's officers. But you must remember, guerrilla warfare is a ruthless pursuit with no quarter given by the guerrillas or the enemy. And let's look at the small, donnish Oxford intellectual Colonel T.E. Lawrence at the Arab Revolt, 1916. He was the first man to employ the strategic possibilities of guerrilla warfare in a national struggle for independence. During World War I, in order to attack Turkey, Germany's ally, he raised the Arabs in revolt against their Turkish overlords. By using guerrilla tactics and operating out of the vastness of the desert, his small forces struck everywhere in the Middle East against the 100,000 occupying Turks and gradually wore them down to defeat. The Turks had 140,000 square miles to defend. And he later wrote, "How would they defend all that? No doubt by a trench across the bottom if the Arabs were an army attacking with banners displayed. But suppose they were an influence, a thing invulnerable, intangible, without front or back, drifting about like gas. Armies were like plants, immobile, firm-rooted, nourished through long stems to the head. The Arabs might be a vapor blowing where they listed. Their deadly raids and vaporous disappearance into the open desert demoralized the Turkish army." And later, ladies and gentlemen, Lawrence of Arabia also carefully assimilated English forces into the Arab guerrillas. They lived and fought with the Arabs and wore their dress. Quote, "Only a sprinkling were employed, not more than 1 per 1,000 of the Arab troops. A larger portion would have created friction just because they were foreign bodies. Pearls, if you please, and the oyster. And those who were present controlled by influence and advice, by their superior knowledge, but not by extraneous authority." End quote. In World War II, we've covered some of that already. But let's look at a little bit more here. Widespread partisan activities throughout Europe, ladies and gentlemen, and guerrilla operations in the Pacific theater finally earned guerrilla warfare its proper place in military strategy. War became a continuation of politics, and the French Marquis, the Polish Home Army, the Yugoslav and Soviet partisans, and resistance groups in Holland, Norway, Denmark, Belgium, all contributed to the eventual defeat of the Nazis. General Eisenhower, in fact, at Normandy, credited the guerrilla activities, 150,000 Marquis against the German army, as equaling the strength of 15 infantry divisions. These and other underground groups were supported throughout the war by British SOS and British SOE, its original name, Special Operations Executive, and the OSS, which is the predecessor to the CIA, etc., out of the U.S., Strategic Services, Office of Strategic Services, and that was under General William Wild Bill Donovan. In the Philippines, for instance, guerrillas led by survivors of Bataan such as Fertig, Blackburn, and Volkman continued the struggle until MacArthur's reinvasion of the islands. They assisted the American forces during the landing on Leyte and Luzon and harassed the Japanese troops on Mindanao until near the end of the campaign. MacArthur called these guerrillas the greatest resistance movement of the war. Now, although Tito was a piece of communist crap, his partisans grew strong in Yugoslavia, so strong that the occupying German army became all but a prisoner of Him. Of course, he got so trained and organized, he also used the same guerrillas to defeat the guerrillas of the pro-American royalists to gain control of the entire country because he was a communist. But think about this. The largest, most effectively trained European army in World War II, the Germans, became prisoners during their own occupation of another country. Now remember something to learn out of Tito's partisans, though, is the fact that political implications down the road of guerrilla warfare. And what happened there? Unfortunately, instead of us backing the pro-American royalists, Mihailoviks, Chechniks, we backed Tito's partisans, a known communist, and it allowed Tito to completely crush and take over Yugoslavia for the communist government, and, of course, the pro-American strugglers, guerrilla fighters, were treated to that same treatment that communism and socialism gives everyone else. Imprisonment and death. Let's look at the Soviet partisans. The Soviets employed mass amounts of guerrilla warfare to defeat the German invasion after 1943 of Russia. They actually had a central partisan command in Moscow to exercise tight control, in fact. Partisans were especially active in the rear of the German Army Group Center. Politically reliable soldiers were parachuted into rear areas to lead guerrilla forces, and operations were carefully coordinated with strategic military plans. For instance, the main railways that the partisans attacked in the spring of 1943 was a large part responsible for the delay of the German offense, which finally bogged down, allowing the Red Army then to make its counterattack, supported by the same partisan actions throughout and behind the lines. For instance, the nights of the 3rd and 4th of August 1943, when 8,600 charges were placed on rails. The standing army couldn't do it to defend their country. The guerrillas were able to. 8,600 explosive charges placed in two nights. Now let's look at what could be called the tragedy of the Ukraine. The Ukrainians were always recalcitrant under communist rule, and they welcomed the German army when they invaded Ukraine and drove out the Soviets. They formed the Ukrainian Insurrectionist Army, the UPA, and fought against the Red Army with the Germans. And they soon realized, however, they had just changed from one socialist dictator in Moscow for another socialist dictator in Berlin. And so the resistance against all forms of dictatorship and a fight for freedom began. They fought effectively against the German army, ladies and gentlemen. The same day the German army would leave an area due to the resistance of the freedom fighters in Ukraine, and the Soviets would come in, the Ukrainians stopped fighting Germans and started fighting Soviets. And this fight has raged from that day clear till now, ladies and gentlemen. The scumbag communist butcher of Ukraine, General Khrushchev, murdered 3 million people trying to stamp out the resistance. And although they were driven underground, they still exist and fight on today. And remember, except for in the past decade and a half, mainly in the last decade, this was done without any sponsoring power or outside help. In the Korean War, for instance, guerrilla operations were carried on in support of the conventional military forces. Guerrillas operated as ranger units. They had limited success because of the failure of us allowing the UN to command the supply. Because of the UN being a communist organization and not really supporting the fight against North Korea, they withdrew support of the Korean guerrillas fighting on our side, who died out because the UN held back intelligence supplies, equipment, and leadership to direct them intelligently against the Chinese and North Korean armies. Cuba, Cyprus, Algiers, Vietnam, Sierra Leone, South America. Because there's so much more current information on them, ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to get into those. It's easy for you to find. That is just a brief history of the operations and introductions to guerrilla warfare. And this leads into more testing, which you'll find out soon how to become involved and get the testing and become responsible for your freedoms, for the freedoms of our country, to be prepared to defend her and probably have to help our neighbors up north, especially to try to keep North America free, to try to reestablish our constitutional republic. And with proper training and practice and research, it can be victorious. It's been proven too many times, ladies and gentlemen, in the past. And I think most of you are quite aware of the fact that many of the highest level generals throughout our U.S. military have already said that our standing military is stretched too thin. They're stretched too thin just for the operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, let alone to defend our country fully. Miserable attrition rates, morale, care after they are done serving, all have compounded themselves. It's not a matter of budget strictly. It's a matter of people who don't know what the hell they're doing because they spent too much time playing hooky from their own National Guard units to avoid Vietnam, that sit in the executive branch trying to run the war when they don't know how to run one. Whether it's legal or not, whether you agree with it or not, the simple fact is, we're not following the 10 basic tenets of warfare. And we covered that. Oh, that was back in 05, I think it was, or 04, that I covered that with Major General Stubblebine here on the Hour of the Time. So, the help and aid of Americans, Canadians, Minutemen, all over North America is going to be a necessary tool when the hammer comes down if you have any hope of restoring a constitutional republic and form a government, restoring freedoms, prosperity, production, independence, and shake off the shackles, both economically and politically, of socialism. Now we're going to go to a musical break. I need to get me a glass of water. I didn't follow my own advice, ladies and gentlemen, when I'm telling you to get ready. I forgot to bring my glass from the kitchen. So, our next phase, after another brief announcement, after the musical break, that is, we'll get on to the subjects of leadership. So here we go, ladies and gentlemen. With another musical break, be sure to stay tuned to the Hour of the Time after, and we'll get into the aspects of leadership. gentlemen. Again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time here with your host, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona, Episode 9 in the Minuteman series. Now, I just have another announcement to make, another couple announcements before we continue on. The McCarthy gun ban bill, which was underhandedly pushed through Congress last week through a voice vote via emails to anti-gun representatives, has now moved to Senate. H.R. 2640. Again, you need to call your senators and tell them they need to dump this bill. And again, it was pushed through with help from the socialist-controlled and inspired National Rifle Association. Paul Helmke, for instance, stated on June 13th on CNN, he's the head of the Brady campaign, "We're hopeful now that the NRA has come around to our point of view in terms of strengthening the Brady background checks, that now we can take the next step after this bill passes to impose additional gun control," end quote. The McCarthy bill is just the first step in a series, ladies and gentlemen, you better get that through your head. And you better get it through your head, all of you idiots who tell me how good the NRA is and send me stupid little NRA bylines in the bottom of your email and wear your NRA hats and send them your memberships, that the biggest organization you claim for gun owners is selling you down the pipe like they've done for 30, 40 years. Besides making a huge national registry and banning weapons ownership for one-fourth of returning veterans, the veterans that fought for that very Second Amendment, we barred. And why is that, you might ask? Clinton, in the year 2000, had put 80,000 to 90,000 names of military veterans who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, into the NICS background check system. Why? Because he wanted to disqualify them from being able to own firearms. People who knew how to use them in defense of our country. Because they had the shakes, didn't like a loud noise coming from behind them. They had nightmares. Typical things of PTSD, they're not crazy, they're not violent. And also, many people have said, well, it won't affect me, I'm a law-abiding citizen. Well, it does affect you. Because hundreds of thousands of law-abiding citizens with the secret moving of names and categories into the NICS background system will one day walk in to buy something and not be allowed to buy it. It will drastically and dramatically expand the current dragnet citizen against law-abiding citizens. The quotes and papers speak for themselves. The NRA has been working in cahoots with people like Dingell, Representative Dingell, who at one time sat on the NRA board, and he was able to use that to bring the NRA into the compromise table again and sell out American gun owners. So I want you to know that. It's pretty obvious. And I don't want to hear a single thing about how good the NRA is or how they're helping American gun owners by compromising your Second Amendment. You can't rationalize it. You're just trying to justify the fact that you wrote them another check for another yearly membership. It's not my fault. You're stupid. Now, if you want information on this current McCarthy situation, you can simply go to Gun Owners of America or JPFO. GunOwners.org, for instance, or JPFO. Both of them reputable organizations really fighting for our rights. And remember, it's H.R. 2640. So you need to look into that and tell your senators to stop it. It needs to just be thrown out. It's idiotic. It's unconstitutional. It's tyrannical. It's socialist. But like the quote I read you from the head of the Brady campaign, Paul Helmke himself, it is just their first step. Now, into the principles of leadership. What is the object, ladies and gentlemen, of leadership? It's generally just to accomplish a job or task. If there was no work to be done, you wouldn't need any leaders. A good leader will know that his purpose is not just to lead, but to also get the job done. If a leader's conduct, demeanor, candor allow him to get the work done well and finish quickly, he is doing his duty. If his actions and manners delay the work or cause it to be done less efficiently, then he is a poor leader, no matter how well he may have been liked by those he leads. Too many would-be leaders, ladies and gentlemen out there, I saw it all the time in the military, ragtag ROTC cadets thinking that they were officers, thought that their only job was to simply inspire their followers to greater efforts by their magic personality. But the truth is, they usually were horrible. And every time I got a cadet assigned to my platoon as platoon sergeant, they didn't last very long. I ran them off like flies constantly, trying to find a good one. Most people have been brainwashed into thinking that they just simply need to inspire their followers to do more work. And that's not how it works. The real truth is, an effective leader can get along quite well without dynamic and fancy-filling personalities. But if he doesn't have the basic skills of organization and respect, not friendliness, but respect of those he leads, he cannot lead and be effective at all. He must have these abilities, he or she, as well as he must be able to quickly survey and understand the overall situation confronting his organization. A leader must be able to quickly sort out the essential work from the unessential work. A leader must be able to place the necessary tasks to be done in proper order of importance, and a leader must be able to get his assistants working on these various tasks with the minimum of lost time or confusion. Delegation of authority, ladies and gentlemen. The leader is instrumental in getting the job done. Those he leads accomplish certain parts of the overall job. And the reason the leader is there and has helpers is to enable him to work at several tasks simultaneously to get the overall job or task completed. A good leader must delegate responsibility and authority, but never entirely, just to some degree. Because a good leader knows that the final responsibility for the task at hand, getting done in a correct manner, is his responsibility and his alone. He also knows, a good leader does, that if they want to have someone else do part of the job, he must do a minimum of 3 basic things. 1, he needs to explain what he wants to have done. He needs to wait until it's finished, two. And three, check to be sure it's done right. During that phase two, wait until it's finished, that waiting time, if you will, the leader should give supervision when necessary and possible. But he must remember, a leader, that those he leads, his workers, whatever they are of value to the leader in reverse proportion to the amount of supervision they require. If they require little or no supervision because of those he's delegated authority to or responsibilities to, they leave the leader free to do other work. If they require too much supervision, he might as well either find someone else who requires less or might as well just do it himself. And if the job hasn't been completed right, the leader must either do it himself or start the three-step process all over again